Hello and welcome to House of Comments. I'm Charlotte Henry. We've got a very special show for you this week. Following Diane Abbott's letter to The Observer about racism, Emma and I have spoken to different representatives of the groups affected. We start with Dr. Dave Rich of the Community Security Trust and author of Everyday Hate, How Anti-Semitism is Built into Our World and How You Can Change It. Hi, Dave. How are you? It's good to speak to you.
Hi, it's good to be on. Thank you.
So we need to start really, I think, at the beginning, which is to ask you, how do you perceive the Labour Party and the issues with anti-Semitism under the leadership of Sir Keir Starmer? Obviously, it was pretty dark days under Jeremy Corbyn. What's your perception in recent years of what has happened?
So the problems that the Labour Party had with anti-Semitism under Jeremy Corbyn are very well documented now. It's been 3 years since Jeremy Corbyn stepped down and Keir Starmer took over. And in that period, they've had to go through a lot of change and I think a lot of soul searching to deal with the verdict of the Equality and Human Rights Commission that they had actually broken the law in their treatment of Jewish members. And there was a whole roadmap to get them out of special measures, which happened earlier this year. I think if you look at what the Labour Party has done under Keir Starmer, I think it's been impressive, being honest. It's not that the problem is completely gone, but the leadership that he's shown, the message that has gone out from him and his team, and the discipline that they have enforced on this issue has been a very important part. You know, they've introduced lots of rule changes and educational programs and all that, kind of the mechanics. But the messaging, I think, has been really helpful and has been right. And the fact that Keir Starmer still now is saying it's not job done. We can't treat it as something that's in the past, but it's a problem that they are aware, having got on top of, and I think they really have got on top of it now. They need to make sure they don't take their eye off the ball. And so that's why I think you have a situation like the speed of the response and the strength of the response from the party to Diane Abbott's letter is something that we probably would not have seen under previous leaders prior to the Corbyn period. And I think this is one of the pieces of learning that they've taken from that experience, is that when problems happen, you can't just wish it away or ignore it. You have to deal with it very quickly.
Yeah, I have plenty of criticisms of Sir Keir during his time. The fact he served on Corbyn's front bench for most of his time, for a large amount of time as leader, would have undoubtedly campaigned for Jeremy Corbyn to be in number 10 and would have undoubtedly served in his cabinet. I have plenty of criticisms of that, but I agree with you that, first of all, in practice, things have clearly got a lot better. If you speak to Labour members, that's very clear. And I think it's not just a performative thing from Sir Keir Starmer. I think he genuinely has a passion for solving this problem. I think he's genuinely ashamed about what happens and wants to fix it. And whatever other critics you want to make of him, I think you have to sort of praise that and at least give them credit for that. I should say a lot of the issues and that came out of the Jeremy Corbyn era and some of the solutions as well are documented in your book, Everyday Hate, and that's very much worth reading. We'll link to it in the show notes. Let's get to this letter then, because it sparked a whole number of issues. I'm sure everyone has heard what it says, but the letter, she said, she cited claims that Irish, Jewish and traveller people all suffer from racism. They were made by Tamima Awaldi. And she said they undoubtedly experience prejudice. This is similar to racism. And the two words are often used as they're interchangeable. But she disputes that Irish people, Jewish people, the traveller community are subjected to racism in the way people of colour are. I was pretty taken aback when I saw this. I think at best you can call this letter ignorant. What was your perception when you read this letter?
I was completely shocked when I read the letter. And even having been through all the problems of anti-Semitism in the party under Corbyn and being completely familiar with some of the thinking in parts of the left on these issues, I was still really shocked. because this letter was in response to an opinion piece, as you said, which was itself describing a very large piece of academic research that highlighted the amount of racist assaults and racist abuse experienced by a whole range of minority groups in this country, including different communities made up of people of color, and then other communities such as Jews and travelers and so on, who are generally perceived as presenting as white. And there were so many problems with this letter, starting with the fact that not all Jews do present as white, and that's a very important thing to say. Secondly,
sorry, I'm going to interrupt you because I'd just like you to unpick that for some people, because here in England, where you see normally see one demographic of Jewish person, which is white of Eastern European descent, basically. Explain what you mean by that.
So in Britain, most Jewish people are what are called Ashkenazi Jews, who originate from Central and Eastern Europe. And generally speaking, Ashkenazi Jews tend to have white skin, or as Diane Abbott put it, white seeming skin, whatever that means. But there are a lot of Jews in the world whose families originate from other parts of the world. There are Sephardi Jews who originate from Spain and Portugal originally. There are Mizrahi Jews whose families have been in Arab countries for, you know, centuries or even thousands of years. There are Black Jews from, and not just, you know, a long-standing Jewish community from Ethiopia, but in Western societies, there are many Jewish people now who are of mixed race, with some Jewish heritage and some Black heritage. And this assumption that all Jewish people are white, just it obliterates all this diversity within Jewish life. And even, I have to say, amongst Ashkenazi Jews who are generally perceived as white, you still quite often find that this still includes a level of visibility of Jewishness in terms of the number of times you get asked, you know, where are you really from? And people assume, you know, because even Ashkenazi Jews will have some element of perhaps darker hair or darker skin coloring within that spectrum. I mean, it sounds ridiculous to be talking in these terms.
It does sound ridiculous, but I think it's important to lay out, because people... It's just important to lay this out, the diversity within the Jewish community.
There is a lot of diversity within the Jewish community. So that's the first problem with the framing of her letter.
Yeah, and because Diane Abbott's letter ended, and at the height of slavery, there were no white-seeming people manacled on the slave ships, which is the line you were talking about.
Now, you know, there is this thinking, this idea that racism is all about skin color, and racism is a system of power and domination that white people impose on people of color. And this is a relatively recent understanding of what racism is. If you go back 100 years, if you go back to the period when my great grandparents came to this country, they were very much treated as a different race. Irish people at that time were very much treated as a different race. Society's thinking and the consensus about what different races are and what racism is and who racism applies to shifts over time. And the reason it shifts over time is because race is essentially kind of an artificial construct anyway. It's not really based in meaningful biology or meaningful science. And it was when in the case of anti-Semitism, you'd had anti-Jewish prejudice on religious grounds and on other grounds for many centuries. It was in the 19th century, this kind of got redefined in racialized terms to give it a scientific and supposedly respectable platform in the kind of new modern scientific rational age. So in the 1800s and the 1900s, anti-Semitism was predominantly talked about and presented and justified in racialized terms, and as a form of racism. And Nazi anti-Semitism was 100% about race and about racism as they understood it. So to ignore all of that, to erase that from the historical record, is completely inaccurate, and it's ahistorical. and it's wrong. And since Diane Abbott referred to travellers also in her letter, let's not forget that the Nazi Germany also committed genocide on Roma and Gypsy communities in Europe for the same racist reasons. Now, you know, we can have an academic debate now about which is the correct use of the word racism. You know, is racism just one kind or another kind? And academics will debate this till cows come home. That doesn't really bother me. What bothered me about Diane Abbott's letter was that she then went from that to imply very strongly that the prejudice, as she put it, experienced by Jewish people and travellers is just not as serious, not as important. You can't equate it to racism experienced by Black people in apartheid South Africa and in under slavery and so on. And that is where I think the real danger is, because it creates this kind of competition, this kind of hierarchy that ultimately nobody benefits from this.
Yeah, I'm very pleased also. I'm glad you raised the horrific racism that the traveller and Gypsy and Roma communities face, because we will be speaking to a representative of that community later on in the show. The line I think you're referring to in Diane Abbott's letter is, she says, in pre-civil rights America, Irish people, Jewish people and travellers were not required to sit at the back of the bus, which, as you say, sort of leads to this idea that there's racism and there's prejudice. And you referred to hierarchies of racism, which is a phrase I've heard used quite a lot in response to this letter. I wondered if you could unpack that for us a bit.
Sure. The biggest problem, I think, when Diane Abbott talks about that line you say, you know, Jews and travellers and Irish people not required to sit at the back of the bus and so on, she gave three examples of historical, you know, systemic racism in the 19th and 20th centuries: slavery, pre-civil rights America, and apartheid. Now, there was one very significant manifestation of systemic racism in Europe in the 20th century that murdered 6 million Jews and hundreds of thousands of Roma and Sinti people and, you know, many others. And she missed it out. And I don't believe she doesn't know about the Holocaust. So that must have been a decision to miss that out. And that hurt. And that, I think, was really unforgivable. This idea of this hierarchy of racism is something that the Labour Party gets accused of, ironically, from people of colour in the party, who argue that anti-Semitism gets privileged and gets treated as more serious by the party than other types of racism and discrimination. And I don't think that's fair. I think the party had to react to what happened under Jeremy Corbyn in a meaningful and serious way. It was forced to legally by the EHRC. And still, most of the complaints that the party has to deal with relate to anti-Semitism. But still, I think everyone generally agrees or ought to agree that a hierarchy of racism is not a good thing. Treating one type of racism as more important than another type, and therefore caring about it more, dealing with those complaints in a privileging kind of way, and then ending up with one part of your party feeling less respected, less valued, is really not where the Labour Party or any organisation should want to be or should end up. And the irony and the tragedy of Diane Abbott's letter, especially given how much racism she's experienced in her life and still does, is that the letter appeared to be endorsing a hierarchy of racism just in the other direction. Whereas really, you know, ideally, an anti-racist tide should lift every boat. Everyone should benefit from broader anti-racism. Every community should. There is no reason why anti-racist action and enforcement in one area should have to be at the expense of another minority group. It should be done across the board, and that's really what we should be aiming for. But her letter seemed very strongly to be arguing in the opposite direction. That's what was so potentially harmful about it.
I have to ask, and sorry if I'm being facetious, how is that argument different to what offended us so much when Jeremy Corbyn said anti-Semitism and all types of racism, which did caused quite a stir in the Jewish community. I certainly did, felt quite offended when he was having to answer questions about anti-Semitism. He seemed to throw it in with everything else.
I think it's all about the context in which he used to say it, because he was saying it in the context of complaints about anti-Semitism and him being challenged about anti-Semitism in the party. And it felt like he was always trying to deflect. Whenever he said anti-Semitism and other forms of racism, it was almost like it gave the impression he couldn't just focus on anti-Semitism as an issue. He had to then take the conversation on to somewhere else. But when it was anti-Semitism that at that time, in that moment, that was the problem that he as leader should have been dealing with. Now, the other part of this, of course, is every type of racism, every type of discrimination has its own particular characteristics and its own contours and specific nature. And we shouldn't miss that out either. You know, when we say they all have to be treated the same, they all have to be treated with the same level of seriousness and importance, but their individual characteristics need to be recognized. Partly because you come up with different solutions for each different type, but also because it's important to recognize and acknowledge the different experiences of different communities, whether that is Black people's experience of racism, Jewish people's experience of anti-Semitism, and so on and so on. They should not be, those differences should not be erased.
I have to say, we mentioned Jeremy Corbyn quite a few times, despite the fact that actually we're really talking about Diane Abbott. Obviously, they're close. They were close allies and friends. But it obviously shows the kind of shadow that Corbyn and that era still cast over the party every time an issue like this comes up. But I want to refocus really on Diane Abbott, because she's a pioneer. She is a political pioneer. She was the first Black woman ever elected to Parliament in 1987. We should say she represents a constituency with a very, very significant, very religious Jewish community in Stamford Hill in London. You would think she would understand that community, having represented it for so long. She clearly engages with it. We know that. And yet we have this letter. We've gone back to this letter. I have to ask you a blunt question. Do you consider this letter anti-Semitic?
I mean, I think you're right to put it in the context of Diane Abbott's career. And like we say, she experiences probably more abuse than any other MP.
The abuse she has put up with in her career is unforgivable.
And that's what makes this letter quite sad, actually, in a way that if someone else had written it, it would be, there'd be less of a sympathetic angle to it. I mean, there were parts of this letter that I think were completely appalling, but I find the whole thing quite sad. I think where the question of anti-Semitism comes in is in the way that the letter relegated the seriousness of the prejudice that Jewish people face when compared to the racism faced by Black people. And I think that is potentially anti-Semitic, because Jewish people face, we know from the data, disproportionate amount of hate crime in this country, disproportionate amount of hate crime in the United States, which was a country she wrote about in her letter.
Well, we're recording this, aren't we, in the week where people in America are marking the anniversary of the Tree of Life synagogue shooting.
Exactly. The that's coming to trial now, you know, and
that's
is
right.
One
it's
of many.
Trial. Sorry, it's not the anniversary,
yeah,
but it's
that is
trial.
One of many terrorist attacks against synagogues and other Jewish buildings in the United States and in Europe in the last decade or so. This is a very real threat. And there are also, you know, there's perhaps an argument from some people that they distinguish between those kind of attacks and structural or systemic racism. But there are parts of the Jewish community in this country that suffer or experience systemic disadvantage when it comes to housing and education and employment. And you can argue whether that's about discrimination or other reasons. But again, in parts of the Jewish community, it's there. So the picture is not so simplistic. It is nuanced. And I think to make the argument she made, to relegate the Jewish experience of anti-Semitism to being comparable to the kind of bullying that people with ginger hair experience, is really quite insulting. And it's quite damaging as well. And that's where I think the question of whether this was an anti-Semitic letter really comes into play.
Do Dr. Dave Rich, head of policy at the CST and author of Everyday Hate, How Antisemitism is Built into Our World and How You Can Change It. Thank you so much for your time.
Hi, this is Emma. One of the things that, following on from the furore, following Diane Abbott's letter, obviously, because of the recent history of the Labour Party, most of the discussion has been about anti-Semitism, and that's right and fair. But all too often, when that happens, other groups get marginalised further and pushed out of the discussion. And it was really glaringly obvious to me that nobody was talking to or about one of the other communities mentioned in her letter, which is the Gypsy and Traveller community. So I thought, why not put that right? So I'm really delighted today to be joined by Sam McLaren, who is a campaigns and communications officer at Family and Friends of Travellers, and Chris McDonough, who's the founder of Travellers Against Racism. Hello, Sam and Chris. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, Emma. Hi.
Thank you for having us.
So first of all, we're going to use what happened this week. This is a, you know, public politics and current affairs podcast. So as a jumping off point for the discussion. So how did you feel when you saw Diane's letter? What was your immediate reaction? I'm happy to come to either of you if you just want to indicate.
I think it's only fair that Chris answer this, given he's from the communities.
Oh, sorry, yeah. Yes, I mentioned Chris himself is an Irish traveller.
Yeah, that's not a problem. I think when I first saw it, I'll be honest with you, it wasn't a shock. It wasn't anything, you know, it wasn't something that kind of, where did this come from? Because, you know, as an Irish traveller, you know, you get used to seeing all these kind of different things being said about Irish travellers within the political community kind of thing. So when I did see it, it wasn't shocking, but it was disappointing, you know, because we're a marginalised community and you know, True Travellers Against Racism will be trying to educate and raise awareness around the certain things and situations that we face as traveller people, and to see something which is kind of diluting the message that I'm trying to get out there. You know, it was disappointing, but, you know, not so much as a shock as you know, maybe it should have been, because, you know, it's, like I said, it's just something that, you know, when it happens all the time to your community, it's something that you get used to, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And were you sort of immediately deluged, Sammy, with lots of requests like this, or did you feel that you were being pushed out of the conversation?
Through friends, families and travellers, when we do see a public figure make any mention of Romani, Roma, Irish traveller communities, it's usually in a denigrating way. So it wasn't a surprise. The biggest surprise was the furore that followed it. Some people within the organisation and outside of it said, this is good. It's highlighting the issues that Romani, Roma and Irish traveller communities experience. Other people said that the communities are being sidelined again. And it has kind of brought on another conversation that seems to have run parallel to the main issue. And actually, even what has kind of unfolded has demonstrated effectively almost Diane Abbott's point, whilst also everyone else's point as well at the same time. So yeah, we were inundated by publications from across the political spectrum, which I working within comms, if you put it that way, you can almost see through, you can kind of read between the lines, and there are questions about the intent behind a lot of the publications that reached out to us, and whether it was, are they looking to highlight the issues facing Romani, Roma and Irish traveller communities, or are they once again packaging these communities into a convenient political football that they can kick towards Diane Abbott's head and the Labour Party more widely? Because, as you kind of mentioned, the history of anti-Semitism and how that's kind of unraveled within the Labour Party. To cut it short, yeah, we were inundated.
So, I mean, you've both mentioned the issues that the communities face. So I think that people are quite unaware of that, particularly when it comes to the racial element. I'd be really grateful. I think it'd be a really good service, actually, if we widen this out from what's just happened to, you know, why this matters. So, Chris, if you could sort of tell us a little bit about your experience and what led you to founding your organisation.
Yeah. So what happened was, it was about 2 years ago, and I was watching a certain programme on the TV, of which I won't mention, but it was a programme which, you know, was about travellers. But then when I was watching it, I was looking at it, and the things that he was stating as fact, and then the things that he was, you know, portraying traveler people as, you know, it wasn't right, it wasn't fair, you know, it wasn't a fair portrayal. So it kind of occurred to me that, you know, things like this is often going unanswered, and you know, the fact that this program was allowed to be made in the first place, you know, it's kind of shocking, to be honest. So in the wake of watching that, I kind of sat there and I just thought to myself, I can't just sit around and complain that these programs are being made and things like that, and this lack of education is, you know, being put forward as the truth, and as, you know, this is who these people are, kind of thing. So I set up my Travels Against Racism accounts to kind of hopefully educate people and you know, help people, you know, break down the stereotypes of which they're led to believe, you know. So overall, I think the message has been that I've been trying to spread is, you know, we are travelers, we're not stereotypes, basically.
Absolutely. And Sam, what are the impacts of the kind of prejudice that the communities face? And is it different for different, so for Roma people, for traveller people, for Irish travellers? Is it different, or is it just sort of everyone is lumped together?
I mean, you've got three distinct minority ethnic groups there, and that's really important to kind of emphasise. You've got the Irish traveller community, you've got Romani Gypsy community and Roma community. Now, there are other communities we also work with, for example, Scottish Gypsy travellers, new travellers, showmen, boaters. Now, some of these are, I think, some are not. But the overarching ones are Romani Gypsy, Irish traveller and Roma. And other ones I mentioned, Scottish Gypsy travellers as well. Now, there, by virtue of a shared history of living nomadically, there are structural issues that we face today for these communities, not me personally. And there are, kind of, as I said, shared issues, but there are also differences. Now, what we're kind of facing is that it is at such an infant stage, the level of data that is actually available to be able to differentiate between the communities. And actually, the thing that triggered, if we're talking about keeping it relatively within the Observer letter playing field, was the Even study that came out recently, which also had the biggest participation of Gypsy, Roma and Traveller people in a national survey to date. And some of the outcomes from it showed, for example, that 62% of Gypsy and Travellers had experienced racial abuse, which was the highest out of all minority ethnic groups surveyed. A particularly shocking one when we're considering kind of Roma people is that 37% of Roman people had been physically assaulted. Now, I don't want to differentiate between racially abused and physically assaulted, bad. But there's something about people feeling that level of ease towards physically attacking someone. Now, that act of physically attacking someone isn't confined to any single group. The physical attack, okay, that kind of whether you're Black or Jewish or Irish traveler, is something that you may experience at some point in your life, and you may experience at a higher rate than, let's say, white British. Now, that is an outcome of the race hate that kind of exists, and the way we look at it at Friends, Families, and Travelers, and we do often say that it's from cradle to grave. So you kind of enter schooling, and Chris may be able to speak about this, and then you're in a space that doesn't affirm who you are. Now, that doesn't mean that you need to have Vado wheels everywhere 24/7, but fundamentally affirming who that child is and who that child feels they are. If you're constantly saying to the child, you're not here, you're not from here, you're not welcome here, that's something they will carry on in terms of their sense of self throughout schooling. And that's something that constantly reaffirmed to them, is that sense of exclusion. We know that young gypsies and travelers disproportionately make up populations of young offenders institutions. They're overly excluded within schooling. They're effectively over-policed within education. They're overly punished. Now, what can we say about what that does to a child's mentality? And then how kind of do we expect them to kind of continue in a space that isn't making them feel welcome? And that's something that we see kind of generationally. So what we'll often see is parents who had a really horrible experience in schooling in the 70s and 80s, who then didn't want their child to go through it. And it's not because, they don't want people going into education, but it's because fundamentally, as a parent, you don't want your child having that same experience. No one would want that. Fundamentally, I'm not a parent myself, but I can't think of many parents who would ever want their child to suffer in that way. So then you finish school and you're meant to get a job, you're meant to start a life. You don't have the qualifications that a lot of places now ask for, so you enter precarious employment, which again, the Even survey found that 85% of gypsy and traveler men were in precarious employment, which actually then kind of shifts, if we're talking kind of identity lines, into a class issue. And it suddenly enters this working class conversation that broadly this country really seems to struggle to have a discussion about. It seems very capable of discussing other things. But the class question and the cross-section between class and race is nowhere near kind of discussed enough. So then you have communities who are within precarious employment, mostly manual labor, who is not a hidden fact that people in manual labor tend to have to retire much earlier because of the physical toil it takes on the body. So then you need to go to the doctor. So then you call up the doctor, but because, let's say, you have an Irish traveler accent, you'll hear that we don't take your kind here. And FFD did a bunch of research on people trying to book themselves into a surgery, a GP surgery, just for an appointment and so on. And we found that only 6 out of 100 were willing to register someone. Right. Yes. So out of those six, or the other 94 were to didn't have room basically to hire someone to register people. So then what happens? Kind of it progresses. You no longer feel you can go to the doctor, and that's something I think everyone can relate. If especially now in the state the NHS is in, if someone's trying to kind of book an appointment, you won't be able to. You kind of end up just saying, screw it, I'm just going to deal with this. We see articles of people crowdfunding their teeth, the work on their teeth, people doing self-dentistry. because that's kind of where people have been pushed to. But these are like day-to-day experiences that Romani Irish traveller and Roma people have to kind of contend with. So
the state that we are currently complaining about the NHS is new is for you guys completely old news.
Yeah, I think Chris maybe.
Yeah, it's definitely old news. It's, you know, growing up at Campton things, you know, some of my memories is, you know, seeing the older people, they're complaining about they have a pain in the tooth and things, and they can't get into a dentist because dentists won't accept them, dentists won't take them in. So they have to deal with themselves, you know. I remember seeing people pulling out the teeth with pliers and, you know, tying a bit of string around and, you know, have to take it out themselves. And that there's not true the, you know, oh, I'm going to do this, look, I look good or whatever. It's not that. They had no other choice. What else was they supposed to do? Suffer in pain or try and deal with it themselves, you know. When you're left with no option but to do that, that's all you can do, you know. It's the same with GPs and surgeries and things. There's a lot of travellers who are afraid to try to join a GP or register with a GP because, you know, they're afraid of the knockback being rejected. You know, it's often shameful. It's shameful that you're going to ask for help and then you finally build up the courage to go and ask for that help or go seek the help. Then you get turned away, you know. What are you supposed to do? You're going to lose all trust and faith in you know, these places that are supposed to help you. So the only thing you can do is try to help yourself, because everywhere else you look, everywhere else you turn is kind of turning you back. So it is something that has been happening for a long time. And you know, I think now maybe in some way there's some people who can understand and a different level now through what has happened with NHS at the moment.
So we've discussed educational exclusion and rejection and health as well as the impacts across both of those have with the class element and precarious work. Taking this up a level, what key, if you could get hold of Rishi Sunak or Keir Starmer tomorrow and say this is the one thing that you could do in the next 5 years for a first term of a Labour government, a millionth term of a Tory government, what one big thing would make a real difference?
I'm just going to dive in here just to basically say, strictly depends who you ask. We can, as an organisation, we're supposed to push all the issues and all the solutions that the people we work with want. Now, some people work with Chris here might say something else, because for him there's another priority. People will say create more safe stopping places. That's the major one. Okay, so Rishi Sunak, whoever goes out and institutes a policy of more safe stopping places. So now gypsies and travellers and new travellers and everyone has a place to stop. Fine, okay. But then when they need to access healthcare, when do we solve that one? And when do we solve education? And how do you solve the hate that exists? It might be a bit of a cop-out to say, but fundamentally working on, to use the word of the 20s at this stage, inclusivity. And promoting that inclusivity, actually promoting cohesion between communities rather than pitting communities against each other, and suggesting that it's Black people's fault that Irish travellers are experiencing exclusion, or that the Jewish community is to blame for Black people experiencing this or that, or kind of any other marginalized group. These are structures that affect everyone, and they even affect people who wouldn't necessarily identify with any single marginalized community. These are issues that affect the wider public. It's just been isolated to certain communities, because it's a really easy discussion to have. It's really easy to say that a single issue could solve all of this, or it's really easy to say that one community is to blame for everything. But from the discussions Chris and I have had, and I'm not even going like 20, 30 years back or back to the Caravan Sites Act of 1968, quite literally the discussion Chris and I have had over the past like 6 months about some of the experiences he has had, which I'm not sure he'd be willing to share on a public platform, but fundamentally trying to exist with something as simple as an accent, you're already entering a whole new thing. So inclusivity and actually promoting cohesion between communities and showing that everyone actually contributes, if, without actually needing to be the exemplary immigrant trope. Yeah. Okay, you don't need to, we don't need Chris to go to the moon for us to kind of just understand that he's a human being with a family and passions and feelings and a care for his own community. It's the communities we live in, not just being an Irish traveller, but Wales at large, Chris.
I don't mind touching on without going into too much detail. So there has within the last couple of months, and you know, within 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, you know, it's not just within the last couple of months. It's been through, you know, my entire childhood, my entire adult life. You know, it's been kind of something that kind of hangs over you as a traveler person, as a traveler man, a traveler woman. It's, you know, the expectation that we're going to be rejected. It's the expectation that we're not going to be accepted. So, for instance, I could walk into a pub, it could be a sunny day, and I think, you know, I'm just going to stop off here. Hard day's work. I'm going to go pop in for a pint or something. I see big groups of you know, stag nights and Hindus, and big groups are going, and I could be with three or four people. And then they'll say, well, just stop me at the door. Not tonight. And I say, well, why not tonight? And they'll turn around, they say, did some kind of excuse, you know, we're full, you was here last week, and I've never been there before. You was here last week, you caused trouble, or it's a policy, or, you know, but these things are set up so that traveler people can't enter everywhere where, you know, everybody else can. We're sidelined, we're pushed to the side. And, you know, this is something that we grow up expecting. And this is something that from a young age, our parents talk to us, and I've had the chat with my children, and we call it the talk. So we had the talk, and the talk is that throughout life they're going to have to expect this racism, because this discrimination based on, you know, just who they are as people. Because, you know, my children and every other child in the world is innocent of anything, but still we're stigmatized from birth, and we are, for want of a better word, we're not accepted, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've talked about a lot of the negative stereotypes and the impacts that they have on so many different areas of public policy. So I would like to turn this around. Now, this is going to probably become out really clumsy, so I apologise in advance, because I'm aware that not only are we talking about several different communities, but also that all individual experiences are different. But I would love to hear some positive stories and just kind of a real kind of an understanding of the joy that being a traveller can bring, and why that identity is important and joyful and should be protected and respected. So it'd be lovely to hear from you, Chris, about kind of, you know, how great it is when it's not being awful.
Yeah.
I apologize. I realize it's a really clumsy question.
No, not at all. So a good thing about being a traveler is, you know, the sense of community we have. For instance, I have a lot of cousins, and you know, we haven't talked for many, many years, but it doesn't matter, because if I turn up at a christening, at a wedding, at a funeral, and we bump into each other, we still talk to each other, we still have that connection, we still walk over, we'll have the conversation, we'll bring up childhood memories and things. There's still that sense of community, that sense of belonging, that sense of family, because, you know, that is what is important, that at the end of it all, family is important, and the connections that we maintain with each other as traveler people. You know, I personally think that within the wider community, there's a lot of, you know, families who kind of distance themselves, and you know, and people can go their own way, and they can they can live their own lives and, you know, kind of fall out of contact. But within the traveler community, there's a lot of, you know, phone calls, still meeting up with old friends that we might have camped with years ago, you know, and there's still the memories and there's still that connection that we tried to hold on to, because, you know, that connection as a people is important. It is important to us.
Brilliant. We started, you mentioned a TV show that portrayed the community very wrongly. I can probably guess what that was. There's a very long history here of the travellers community. What should we know? What should we be being taught in schools that we're just not at all?
I think one of the biggest things that I personally think should be taught in schools is that we are not the weird outside monsters bogeyman that people, you know, portray us as. We're people, you know. We're the same as you, you know. We might live in a trailer or have a different culture or whatever, but we're at the end of it, we're still people. And, you know, I think that there's a lack of education around who we are and our customs. And, you know, from the outside looking in, our customs and our you know, the things within our culture could seem a bit strange, but that's from an outside looking in. But if you was educated, if people was educated and our customs, our culture and things, you know, when you're looking at it, it wouldn't seem strange, because, you know, it's something that you've learned already. So I think education is very important. I think education is key in you know, the inclusivity that we're kind of seeking.
Brilliant. Guys, I'm going to let you go. Is there any final words, any final messages that you'd like to say? Where can people find you? Anything you'd like to just add at the end? Sam, I'll come to you first.
Our website is gypsy-traveller.org. That's gypsy-traveller.org. Just because there's the American spelling that sometimes it gets confused with. The main thing, I mean, that's about as far as organizational self-promotion I'm willing to go to. I think the main thing is get in touch with your local Gypsy Traveller organization. They do exist. There aren't many, but they do exist, and they do some really great work. It's a digital world and so on. Do the whole follow of all the organizations. Keep up to date with their work. There's a lot of good work happening that doesn't get the visibility. There's publications like Travelers Times as well who work quite hard to promote kind of news within the communities that's actually positive. Things like food bank drives over Christmas and so on that don't get the limelight they deserve. And at Travelers Against Racism, because they are a good bunch.
And Chris, I'm going to give you the last word.
Thank you for having us on, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to, you know, speak about these things that you know is important to me.
Well, thank you so much, and can I say, often I reach out to organisations and they've got an awful lot on, and I'm sure that you guys do too. So you've been incredibly responsive and helpful, and made my life incredibly easy. So thank you for that. And I really appreciate you taking your time out today to come and talk to me, and hopefully just give our listeners a little bit more to think about.
I hope you found this episode useful and informative. We'll be back next week, so please share this episode, subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts, and we'll see you then.